Disc 1. Dear Mr. McKenna, I finished reading your book, Spiritual Enlightenment, The Damnedest Thing, and I'm so mad I could chew nails. While you tout your book by its very title as a spiritual book, it is nothing about spirituality, and was very disturbing to boot. I wish I'd never read it, but believe me, if you write another book, I'll not be buying it. Do you realize that if people do as you suggest, that their lives would be ruined? Maybe you never had anything to lose, but most people do. It's like some fairy tale world you live in, where you think everyone is independently wealthy and are able to come and go without commitments to an employer, to say nothing of family, friends, and community. Like you think a mother can leave her children to go off on this spiritual pursuit, or wild goose chase, I'd call it. Who would do that? What for? Who would want to? Not realistic. Not happening at all. I have responsibilities to my family, friends, and my community. I do volunteer work at a local shelter and organize food drives for the poor in my community. I'm a member of the Women's Guild of our church. I help my children with their homework, provide good meals and a clean, happy home. They have extracurricular activities like dance, soccer, music lessons that enrich their spirit. You expect me to drop everything I value in my life, things that give meaning to my life. It'll be flushing everything I value down the toilet. Real lives are at stake here, and you talk as though it's nothing more than a stage. Get real. What you call enlightenment, I call a horrendous nightmare. I can't imagine how or why you say such things. Just to sell books? Even if the things you say are true, who cares? What's so great about truth? I'd rather have my family and my life where I believe real spirituality is available to each and every one of us through kindness, goodwill, an open heart and mind. What would you know of that with your nihilism and your void? I think it's rich that someone would write a book about spiritual enlightenment who admits they don't even know what the word spiritual means. So, maybe you will sell a lot of books. I don't know why anyone would accept your version of spirituality. It's the opposite of everything that's good and beautiful about life. It is opposite of love and God and family, and yet what's it all for? There's no point. Even you yourself say that there's no point. Yet you advocate to your readership that they put all else aside to become, in essence, total failures. The damage I would do to others' lives would be irrevocable. They would hate me. And for what? Absolutely nothing. Judging from all the rosy testimonials in the front of your book, there are people out there who believe you are a great spiritual master. I don't think you have a spiritual bone in your body. I've had the wonderful privilege of being in the presence of individuals who were truly enlightened, but you are nothing like them. Put that on the front of your next book, so people like me won't waste their time. Reprinted by permission. Name withheld by request, Seattle, Washington. Spiritually Incorrect Enlightenment by Jed McKenna. Copyright 2004, Wise Fool Press. All rights reserved. This book is dedicated to Herman Melville. Do not think the Buddhas are other than you. Dogen. Chapter 1. Loomings. And that the great monster is indomitable, you will yet have reason to know. Herman Melville, Moby Dick. Call me Ahab. Though in truth I am more Ahab than Ahab, I am the underlying reality of Ahab, the fact upon which the fiction is based. Captain Ahab is a rendering, the literary likeness of a true thing. I am that true thing. One might reasonably expect the shelves of our libraries to be spilling over with tales of courageous men and women who've dedicated their lives to the selfless quest for truth. But, in fact, such tales are so exceedingly rare that we may fail to recognize them when they do appear. Herman Melville's Moby Dick is not a book about whaling, or madness, or revenge. It's a book about one thing, and one thing only: man's pursuit of truth, truth at any price. Captain Ahab is not just a literary character. He is a human archetype, a fundamental yet unknown human archetype. All the world's a stage, all the men and women merely players, and Captain Ahab is the final role, the role that sets us free. Whoever wishes to awaken from the dream state of duality into the reality of their being must step out of their current character and into the role of Ahab, must become Ahab. Ahab is monomaniacal, focused entirely on one thing to the exclusion of all else, and that's the way out of the dream. The only way. Chapter 2. California Dreaming. The spiritual master is absurd, like everything else. He is a function that serves to enlighten or awaken beings from this condition that is absurd and unnecessary to begin with. The occupation of the spiritual master is as absurd as anything anyone else does, you see. Therefore, it requires a sense of humor, or the enlightened point of view. Da Avabhasa. I hate L.A. There, I said it. I hate L.A., and L.A. hates me. I don't know why Los Angeles and I hate each other, but I must admit I'm a little embarrassed about it. For me, L.A. is a no-flow zone where things don't work in the smooth, easy way to which I'm accustomed. Maybe it's only a no-flow zone because I hate it, but I think the no-flow came first. I usually just try to stay out of L.A., but that's hard to do when flying into LAX. Christine and I are picked up at the airport by Henry, a man who stayed with us at the house in Iowa for several months a few years ago. When he heard that I was coming out, he was very eager to put us up. Now we're in L.A., and I have the uneasy Hotel California feeling I always get when coming here that, once in, I'll never get out. Christine is like my personal assistant, I suppose. A few years ago, Sonea started sending someone with me whenever I travel to take care of things. I always argued against it, but Sonea wouldn't listen, and now I'm hooked. The additional cost of a travel assistant is a small price to pay to avoid dealing with hotel clerks and rental car clerks and airline clerks and all the rest. She probably saves me more than she costs anyway. Usually, when I travel now, a few times a year, I call Sonea and ask if she has anyone who'd like to go with me. Christine has done this several times. She's a bit on the small side and quiet, dresses in very conservative grays and blacks, but she eats clerks for breakfast, and we never get jerked around. She runs interference for me, providing a protective layer between me and a world in which I no longer function very well. She's very religious, I think, and has no sense of humor, not a playful bone in her body. I think she sees me as a likable idiot, but I wouldn't bet on the likable part. Henry is a very likable person, very open and talkative, unabashed. If penile dysfunction is what's on his mind, then that's what you're going to hear about. Penile dysfunction is not what's on his mind at the moment, but what is on his mind actually makes penile dysfunction sound pretty appealing. During the drive, he speaks animatedly about the new spirituality they're inventing, he and his California friends, a fully integrated spiritual lifestyle that allows them to live their beliefs 24/7, as he says. A fully integrated spiritual lifestyle, that's what he keeps calling it. Fizzle, I think. That's how the acronym would be pronounced. Once again, I am struck by the fortress-like impenetrability of the walls ego erects around itself. I remember Henry as an earnest, attentive, and thoughtful person. I don't recall ever thinking he might really buckle down and wake up in this life. But I do recall that he was trying to achieve some level of self-honesty and might manage to make a break from his ego. Now, listening to him talk about his newfound integrated spirituality as we drive through interminable L.A., I am saddened to see that he has spun away from his honesty and is now cozily nestled in a self-gratifying, ego-preserving cloak of spiritual hedonism. Oh well. I'm trying to avoid saying that I hate California. I keep trying to think of something I like about California so I don't have to face this petty truth. But I can't do it. I hate California. Maybe California is really a lot of different places, and there are probably parts I'd like. But I think that's just the denial talking. I should just say it and live with it. I hate California. I'm not sure why I hate California, but if pressed, I'd say that it has something to do with Californians. There's no area of our lives that isn't spiritually grounded, Henry informs me animatedly. We've reconfigured our lives in every area. We've minimized the waste we create and maximized our utilization of replenishable resources. We're experimenting with a variety of alternative fuels and energy sources, and several of us are incorporating hydro, and on he goes. The drive takes forever, and there's nothing to see the whole way. Henry goes on and on about the new paradigm he and his friends are creating, and Christine is quietly absorbed in her knitting. The car is a high-end Mercedes, so I can't complain about the ride, which also aggravates me. I'm curious as to where an $80,000 luxury sedan fits into this new spiritual lifestyle, but I'm afraid that if I ask, he'll answer. When I use words like love and hate, what I really mean is more like attract and repel in the energetic sense. No-flow places and ego-bound people repel me, as do ego-saturated places where the greed and vanity of the people seem to permeate the place. Whatever doesn't repel me is either neutral or attracts me. This is true of everyone, but most people drown it out. It's much subtler than love and hate. It's at the level of energy. And when your energy is distorted, you're distorted. Los Angeles distorts me. California distorts me. These distinctions do not apply to me as a truth-realized being, but as a being detached from ego, a more common and accessible state. This book will attempt to cover the distinction between those two states in depth and gently encourage its readers away from the former and toward the latter. I notice that Henry is still speaking. We all have green portfolios. That means, Henry, I say, that we only invest, Henry, in companies that have demonstrated, Henry, yes, you have to shut up. Don't talk anymore. Seriously, you're killing me. Oh, okay. Sure, that's not a problem. Yeah, heck, you've been flying and driving probably since all day. I should just shut up and let you refresh your spirit. There's a hot tub and a pool at the house, and we don't use the dangerous chemicals. And on he goes. I feel my brain begin to swell inside my skull until finally the pressure is unbearable, and it explodes, coating the interior of the car and my fellow occupants in a strawberry jam of blood and goo. Or is jelly the lumpier stuff? I can never remember. Since one of the things I'm trying to do with these books is hold the awakened state up for display, I should mention one of the more peculiar things about it, which is that I have nothing to do. I don't have any challenges left, and I can't just make one up. I can write this book and maybe stay involved with communicating on this subject in some minor way, but the fact remains, I have nothing to do. I like being alive, but I don't really have anything to do while alive. I like to sit and be. I like to appreciate the creative accomplishments of man, especially as they involve his attempts to get his situation figured out. But appreciation is a pretty flat pastime. I'm not complaining, just expressing something about this state that most people probably aren't aware of. I am content, and contentment is overrated. I have no framework within which anything is better than anything else, so what I do doesn't particularly matter. I have no ambition, nowhere to go, no one to be or become. I don't need to distract myself from anything or convince myself of anything. There's nothing that I think isn't as it should be, and I have no interest in how others see me. I have nothing to guide me except my own comfort and discomfort. I don't seem to be too bored or unhappy about it, so I guess it sounds weirder than it is. Stink pig bastard Henry has sandbagged me by dragging us to a friend's house for a dinner party. There are 5 or 6 couples, as well as Christine and me, who are not a couple. It's a spacious Spanish-style house surrounded by others like it, overlooking a valley of dirt and scrub. And if you turn the telescope on the balcony far enough to the left, I'm told, a glimmer of ocean. The East Coast dinner parties of my youth were pretty formal affairs. Everyone arrives 7-ish, drinks for an hour-ish, seated 8-ish, finished 9-ish, more drinks until 2-ish. This doesn't look like that. Less formal, less uptight. This is more like an indoor picnic. Everyone comes and goes. Children with sitters or nannies stop in and leave. The occasional teenager zips in, consults with a parent about car keys or cash, and zips out. A neighbor pops in to discuss on-street parking and pops out. People are chatting in 4 or 5 different areas, including the driveway, the balcony, and the kitchen. There's no one making introductions, no proper young gents taking coats and drink orders, no enchanting hostess gliding through the scene, no one smoking, no dresses or ties, no cocktails, mostly wine and some beer, no soft chamber music, no candles, because the house is flooded with sunlight. Henry has pulled me aside and is continuing to batter me with details of Operation Fizzle. These people we're dining with are all a part of it, he tells me. It's something they're creating and discovering together. This dinner party is an example of it. Sometimes we get together just to discuss a single topic, he informs me. Have you ever done that? It usually has to do with social responsibility. Sometimes we discuss a book. There are a lot of us, not just what you see here. It's really gaining momentum. We're creating a whole new paradigm. Okay, too much. I have no idea what you're talking about with this new paradigm stuff, Henry, I tell him. The paradigm I see here is denial and petty self-interest, just like anywhere else. You might spin it differently, but it's the same life structure that practically everyone is living in. Is there something I'm not seeing? It looks like you're all half a block off Main Street, living perfectly ordinary, self-gratifying lives, and going to a lot of trouble to pretend you're not. How is this different from what anyone else is doing? Henry is unflappable. Do you think we should consider a less self-centered approach? He asks, rubbing his chin with a judicious air. That's something I've been wondering about. We participate in quite a few charitable projects. I think we're all volunteers in various organizations. We all recycle, of course, and we're very conscientious about the environment. I guess we could be more giving if you think... I don't think anything, Henry, I interrupt. You're the one talking about a new paradigm. I'm just saying I don't see it. On the one hand, these people, Henry and his friends, are clearly very pleasant, very successful Americans, living the American dream of freedom and abundance. On the other hand, I can't help but see them all as self-centered, self-important, self-righteous assholes. In other words, youngsters. But they're not really, or at least not particularly. No more or less than anyone else at any other dinner party, certainly not those of my early years. It's just another sign that my good humor is wearing thin. How do mature, intelligent people manage to go through their lives in a state of such diminished capacity? And what do I care if they do? In reality, there's only one thing going on. There's only one game being played in life, and these people have arrayed their mental and emotional forces expertly so as to convince themselves that they're on the field in the thick of it, while actually standing in line at the snack bar. The American dream of freedom and abundance is just a child's rendering of true freedom and abundance, and serves only to convince people who haven't gone anywhere that they've already arrived. To the awakened mind, the unawakened can be a source of frequent dismay. The distance between awake and asleep is so infinitesimal that it's hard to remember they're a universe apart. Zen parables about instant enlightenment seem suddenly probable, as if just the right event, the whack of a stick, a poignant non sequitur, an overturned bowl, could suddenly snap someone into full awareness. The unawakened mind sees an enormous barrier, the proverbial gate, between itself and the awakened mind. The awakened mind sees with perfect clarity that no such gate exists. Hence, frequent dismay. The really strange thing about being awake isn't being awake. It's the people that aren't. They're walking and talking in their dream states, some of them declaring their deep commitment to waking up while doing everything possible not to. Have you ever been around a sleepwalker who had their eyes open and was performing a task, even speaking? It's pretty eerie. Now imagine the whole world is like that. It's eerie and it's lonely. But more than that, it's dubious. It lacks credibility. It's not believable. Even at the level of consensual reality, it's hard to accept that these people are all really asleep. I'm able to interact to some degree with sleepwalkers, but they're speaking from within a dream state world that I can't see and only barely remember. They might say they want to wake up, but it quickly becomes apparent that they have some dream world notion of what awake means that might involve anything, so long as it doesn't disturb their slumber. Ego's guard dog is ever vigilant, and it bites. They say that sleepwalkers get violent if you try to wake them. A curiously apt parallel. I see Christine giving me a look. I understand what her look means, but not why she's giving it. She wants to know if I want her to do what she does, which is shield me from yucky stuff. She wants to know if I want her to get me out of here. That means I have to stop and think, because I wasn't aware of anything here that I'd want to be shielded against, besides spiritual banality, which wouldn't cause Christine to give me the look. These are intelligent, successful people. I probably don't depict it well, but Henry alone has more intelligence in his nose than I have in my whole head. I was intelligent once, as I recall, in some previous life that I might have read about in a book, for all the connection I feel to it. If I ever had much in the way of intelligence, I no longer do. I've gone soft in the head. I don't see beyond the surface of things anymore. I'm not naturally suspicious, because the only thing in the universe that merits distrust is ego, and I tend to stay clear of it. But now Christine is giving me the look, and after a few seconds of thought, I see why. I see that Henry has set me up. That's what's going on here. I am this evening's entertainment. Henry put me in this situation, knowing that at some point I wouldn't be able to contain myself, and I'd begin to talk, which for me, as Henry knows, means launching into a rant, a performance. Now that I see it, it's obvious. I laugh at my own gullibility. On the other hand, I don't get the chance to perform much anymore, so what the hell? We'll see what happens. I gesture to let Christine know it's okay. I sit at the dinner table and try to appear interested in the conversations around me. I'm drinking bottled water. Christine has sparkling cider. Everyone else is drinking wine and discussing wine. Only Henry, his wife, and Christine know anything about me. Henry's wife's brother's wife, Barbara, is on my right. She brought the salad. I remark on how good it is, and she provides some backstory. Indy, that's my boy. He's 8. His name is Indy? I ask, guessing that it's short for Indiana. Yes, she says. It's short for independence. He was born on the 4th of July. I nod mutely. Well, Indy heard Mommy and Daddy talk about recycling and how it's a good thing. So he wanted to recycle the kitty litter. Isn't that sweet? He wanted to invent a way of reclaiming the used, you know, soiled gravel from the clumps. Very environmentally aware for an 8-year-old, I say, wondering how this ties into the salad. Isn't he? Well, the little guy scooped practically the whole litter box into my salad spinner. You know, the cage in a bowl thing that spins and uses centrifugal force to dry the lettuce? I nod and force a smile, wondering if we'll all need our stomachs pumped at the end of this story. Indy filled it up with used kitty litter, straight out of the cat box, and was just pulling the string and spinning and spinning. Meanwhile, I'm in the kitchen looking everywhere for my salad spinner, because I'm in the middle of preparing the salad, and we're running late as it is. I laugh in commiseration, really hoping that she'll skip forward to the part that explains the mysterious crunch in the salad. Finally, the housekeeper comes in carrying my beautiful salad spinner, completely clogged with awful cat mess. I was furious, she laughs. It seems dry, I say, coaxing her toward the bottom line. Yes, well, I had no choice, did I? She asks me, and I fear the worst. I could hardly serve the salad wet, could I? No. Of course not. So I tossed it in a pillowcase, tied off the opening, and threw it in the dryer for a few minutes. The salad? I ask. Just the lettuce, she says. No shit, I say. Nope, she says brightly. Not a drop. I've decided to strangle the next one that swirls their wine and sniffs it. Not really, of course, but a larger part of me that I care to admit finds it hard to believe that I'd get in trouble for it. I'm perfectly aware that these people's lives are theirs to do with as they wish. I'm perfectly aware that it's their party, and that I'm the turd in the punch bowl. I'm perfectly aware that I'm the reality freak, and that they're just children playing in their own playground, minding their own business. It's not that I want to crack their shells, just for the sake of shaking them up. I don't want to assume the role of spiritual mucky-muck with this crowd or any other, and I sure as hell don't want to save anybody. Save from what? Life? What always makes me buggy, though, is that life played by the rules is more wonderful and exciting by countless orders of magnitude than life played by make-believe. It's a great, amazing, perfect thing, and they're totally missing it. The game of their lives is passing them by as they sit around the dinner table, swilling wine and inflicting their daintily coiffed opinions on each other. They're busy playing dozens or hundreds of mind-numbing little games in order to avoid the only real game. And I can't help but think that if they just learn to deal with their fear a little bit, they could pull up a seat and get in on the game of their lives. It's about what really is, and what really is actually very cool once you get to the place where you can look at it directly and begin to understand your relationship to it. It's not about truth realization or spiritual enlightenment. It's just about facing facts, the facts of life. And most people go through their entire lives doing nothing other than avoiding the facts. What makes me buggy isn't that they're a bunch of fucking morons. We're all fucking morons. It's that I know something that I'm sure they'd really like to hear, and I'm sure that I could get through to them if I just express myself clearly. I'm the real fucking moron, of course, the odd man out, and I'm sure my thinking closely resembles that of any wide-eyed fanatic who thinks they're the only one with the inside line. In my own defense, I'd like to say that I get caught up in situations like this one quite infrequently. For the last few years, I've pretty much stayed clear of people altogether, and that's worked out to everyone's satisfaction. After dinner, everyone remains seated at the table. A few liqueurs are set out, and everyone pours their own. Everybody's getting buzzed. The subject of terrorism and America's vulnerability comes up. The threat that has everyone spooked is some major combination attack on the food and water supplies, which, I take it, was narrowly averted in recent weeks. Had it been successful, they're saying, it would have left everyone to fend for themselves to stay alive. They seem to be almost morbidly fantasizing about possible scenarios in which a cascade failure of services occurs, followed by anarchy, rioting, and the eventual loss of the cities and infrastructure. The women are obviously very uncomfortable with the discussion, but the guys can't get enough. "Oh, it's all just too terrible to think about," says one of the women. "It's too terrible not to think about," says one of the men. "We live in a desert. It wouldn't be long before our situation was critical, a day or two." "Well, I'm sure there are food and water supplies somewhere. The National Guard would be..." "The President would..." "I don't think so," says Henry. "Not for long, and probably not out here. And say you get through the first few days with what you have, then what? And what do you do when someone shows up with a gun to take what you have? You can't call the police. You don't even know who your friends are anymore." They go on in this vein for a while, heaping on more horrors, remarking on how fragile our system really is, how terrible it would be if anything happened to it. They are simply oozing with the grim importance of it all. Finally, the dancing bear can stand it no more. Well, let's say the worst stuff you can think of really happens, I interrupt. Would that really be such a tragedy? The chatter stops as all eyes turn to me. Would it really be so bad if your world broke apart at the seams? I ask. Cascade failures and anarchy and all that? I could see where it might be a pretty good thing. Shake things up. Get the blood flowing. They're exchanging glances with each other in smug bemusement, seeking an explanation for, or complicity against, the jackass making this unscheduled deviation from standard themes. I don't know any of you personally, I continue, but it looks like your lives are fairly predictable. You know how this storyline plays out, right? So what would be so bad if this storyline shifted abruptly to something a little more exciting? For better or worse, I have their attention. Henry looks happy. I'm just playing the devil's advocate here, thinking out loud. Correct me if I'm wrong, but your lives are pretty much... I make a gesture indicating our current setting. This, right? I mean, you make money, raise kids, socialize, fulfill your roles, just like everyone else, basically ambling in small circles toward your own graves while pretending you're not. Sure, you all meditate and do whatever spiritual practices, but you know that's not really going anywhere, right? A few pockets of resistance pop up, but I plow over them. Their indignation is as meaningless to me as the growls of little pink puppies. I'm indulging myself with a somewhat more forceful manner of communicating now, mainly for my own amusement, and their reaction at this stage is not a factor. This end-of-the-world thing of yours sounds so terrible, I say, but maybe... it would be your one real chance. You might not know it, but what you're fantasizing about is waking up, your own awakening. You've heard the Chinese saying that's both a blessing and a curse. May you live in interesting times. If you look at it, you'll see that we don't live in interesting times, but we could. That's what your terror scenario is really about, isn't it? The times becoming interesting. We'd have perfect seats for one of the greatest spectacles in the history of the world, the meltdown of an advanced technological civilization. As you've pointed out, it wouldn't take much. Food and water run out in a few days, and all pretense at decency and morality run out with them. Major cities panic and go berserk. Fire, riots, evacuation. It'd be the greatest unmasking the world has ever known. A mass awakening. Millions of people getting very real, very fast. You don't think that'd be fun? They're looking at me like I'm crazy, stupid, or just unbelievably rude. I'm directing my words mainly to Henry, so the others will feel that they're watching a conversation and not being directly provoked. They see that Henry isn't offended, so they resist the urge to jump in. It's not too improbable, I guess. Terror, nuclear mishap, some planetary event, war, a microbe, an act of God. Things change, fall apart, end. No rule against it, right? Imagine America reduced to a land of warlords and city-states, marauding bands of peevish Merlot sniffers roaming the countryside. Henry laughs and lifts his wine glass. Sultry bouquet! Sultry bouquet! He shouts like a rallying cry. I laugh too. This is fun. Any hope of a return to normalcy vanishes. The people we call primitive are unaffected and go on about their lives undisturbed, while the entire wired world descends into savagery. Not in years or months, but in weeks, days, We'd see how our deeply held values stand up to an empty stomach. How many meals do you miss before you stop loving thy neighbor and slit his throat? This civilized veneer is really quite thin. Make a study of the human in extremis. Prison camps, lost at sea, and all that. And you'll see it's not just the veneer of civilized behavior that's thin. Friendship, morality, honor, all disappear. Distinguishing physical characteristics disappear. And what about love? When the going gets tough, we'll steal food from our own starving children. We're wired to survive, and love doesn't override wiring. This isn't going over at all well. I don't really mean us here, sitting at this table, I continue, because this is all a veneer, too. These cheerful, well-fed personas are just flimsy veils of consciousness laid over the animal within and don't survive even minor discomforts. Everyone's looking down and around, and my sense is that they'd like one among them to stand up and put me in my place. Who we think we are can be stripped away forever. I make a poof gesture, just like that. Right now, well-fed, unthreatened, we have the luxury of pretending the Donners and the Nazis and the gangbangers are someone else. But they're not. They're us, a veil's breadth away. There are no good guys and bad guys. People are people, all the same. Only the circumstances change. I take a breath and let all that sink in. I stand up and start to pace as I resume the diatribe, both for my own energy and so no one mistakes this for a conversation. They are silent now, watching the show. Maybe it's the words or the force behind them, or maybe it's just the spectacle, but they're all fixed on me. No swirling and sniffing, no smug sideward glances. Henry is positively beaming with delight. He got his show. I grab a carrot stick and take a bite. It could be the death-rebirth process, but on a planetary scale. Very interesting to think about. This whole ego-based society burns to the ground. Years of chaos and anarchy follow. But then something rises from the ashes. What? Probably another ego-based society born of might instead of right, of rancid fear, but maybe not. Maybe something else. Heaven on earth, right? Get ourselves back to the garden, don't you think? That's the process the individual has to go through. So why not a society? It's the kind of thing that seems like an unimaginable nightmare before and a godsend after. The death and rebirth of Western civilization. A human evolution revolution. Pretty cool, huh? Henry seems to think so. The others aren't so sure. This hijacking of a conversation and blowing it out is something I can do as easily as popping a balloon. I just take the subject to a more interesting level and show everyone how it looks from there. You'd think people would get offended, but I don't slow down for that, and their initial reaction quickly subsides as they see that something different from conversation is happening, and they get on board. Am I wrong about anything? I ask and look at each of them. This whole breakdown of services and infrastructure is your thing. I'm just saying it might be a good thing. Amusing. Burn it all. I wave my carrot stick to indicate Western civilization. I mean, why not? It's not really going anywhere, is it? Another tired storyline. Death and rebirth, right? Is there any other way? I look around. No one speaks. Now, compare that to these bland little lives you're dozing through. What are you really doing? crawling toward cancer and heart disease and prolonged, agonizing deaths. Am I wrong?
Oh, one or two of you might get lucky and die in a car accident, or have a heart attack in your sleep, or be murdered by your spouse, but that's really the best you can hope for. None of you seem self-determined enough for suicide.
Compare that cheery outlook to this worst-case scenario of yours.
Sure, you probably wouldn't last long, but what a way to go. A world in flames. But you people don't want that because, what? You've got something more important going, I guess. Like what? Your plans? Your careers? Your future? Your children? Your children are just less developed versions of you, and their hope of breaking out of the cycle of denial is no better than yours. And even if it were, that's no reason. The only reason is fear. Your fear gives birth to your denial and your cozy, insular delusions of permanence and continuity. Look at yourselves, getting together so you can reaffirm each other's self-image fantasies and tell scary stories about how the big bad wolf could huff and puff and blow your world down.
Wow, we really dodged a bullet there, you say about this terror thing.
But what you dodged was your own lives. Sorry to be such a bore. Got any cake?
I go into the kitchen and find coffee and tiramisu.
I serve myself and take it out onto the deck. The coffee is spiced, I discover, and toss it over the rail.
Now there's no point to the tiramisu.
I scan the distant hills and wonder why everyone isn't more like me. It was probably stupid of me to launch into a rant against these nice, middle-class people and their harmless, middle-class lives. But boredom makes me do stupid things. This is one of the pitfalls of venturing out into the world. I get sucked down into the quag of other people's bullshit. I don't have anything against people or their bullshit. I'm just not well suited to getting sucked into it. I suppose I could have sat there all evening and suffered the minor indignity of nodding and feigning interest in wine, cars, politics, and worthy causes, perhaps even injecting the occasional inanity. But I think my tolerant days are behind me. And I mean, really, who gives a rat's ass what I say anyway? So I might as well speak my mind. At least tonight will be memorable. I hear someone come out and turn to see Christine. She's probably pissed off at me, too, though I don't think she looked up from her knitting during the entire performance. I suppose we've overstayed our welcome, I say. Sorry if I embarrassed you. Please arrange a car and some rooms. We'll get the bags from Henry's. Don't let him take us. She shakes her head. You're a hit, she says. They'd like you to come back in. They have questions. No kidding, I say. Good for them. But I don't really feel like being a hit. Find us a car anyway. Don't get us rooms. Get us planes. Planes? Where?
Cedar Rapids for you. LaGuardia or Newark for me.
Really? Really, I say. Trip's over. I gotta get out of this place. But what I mean is, I gotta get away from people. Well, what do you advise we do? Henry asks when I return to the dining room. Everyone's still sitting around the table. I take my seat. I don't advise you to do anything. Go on about your lives. Don't listen to anyone who tells you you're wrong. You're not wrong. That's a fact. Don't do anything different. I was just toying with ideas, extrapolating, exaggerating for comic effect. You don't think there'll be some sort of cataclysmic event? Sadly, no. It doesn't appear to be indicated. Okay. Well, what would you do if you were in our position?
I'd chew my leg off to get out of your position, I say.
It would hurt like hell and probably kill me, but that's my automatic response to confinement. It's a decision I made long ago. I don't even have to think about it.
But that's not what you'd advise any of us to do?
No.
Why not?
Because you have lovely lives, and even if you are asleep, so what?
That's life.
You're having a wonderful dream, so what's the point of waking up? Why mess with such a nice setup? Nothing hangs in the balance. Look at how you live. You're in the top 1% of the top 1% of the most fortunate people who have ever lived. You want to fuck with that?
Chapter 3. Dicking Around. Every man is tasked to make his life, even in its details, worthy of the contemplation of his most elevated and critical hour. H.D. Thoreau.
I'm sitting out on the balcony waiting for our car. It's dark now, and there's only one bench that has a proper view. A kid of about 20 comes and sits there, too. He has a beer and lights a joint. We're far enough from the house that he could flick it over or douse it in his bottle if anyone comes out, assuming he'd care. He offers it to me, and I decline. He talks the way kids do about the way his parents and the others inside are. He's got that tiresome teen angst thing going, and he's pretty buzzed. He asks me why I'm here.
I'm not, I say, recalling a conversation under similar circumstances from college.
Huh?
I'm not really here, I repeat, wondering if he'll go for it, if he's in the right state of mind.
Oh, yeah, sure. So where the fuck are you really?
Same place you are. Another place and time.
He scoffs and takes another hit off the joint. He looks at me.
How poetic. I'll say this. You're a lot more interesting than those fucking cadavers inside.
You're not.
He stiffens.
Yeah? Well, fuck you, too.
That's what I'm here to tell you. That's why I came here tonight. In a few years, you're exactly the same as those people in there. That little heat you have now will be gone, and you'll mock those in whom it appears. That's your future, and you'll live it for more than 60 years in a walking coma. I point inside, just like them. He laughs at me, pauses, considers, laughs again.
You're so full of shit, you're almost interesting. What are you, some Philip K. Dick fanatic? Go around messing with people's heads?
Reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away, I say.
He scoffs. What's that? More poetry?
Philip K. Dick, I say. He doesn't speak for a few minutes. I enjoy the view, and he enjoys his joint and his beer.
Okay, he says after a while. I'll bite.
Where are we, you and I? Really?
A private facility in the Canadian Rockies, Banff, British Columbia. It's called the Scherer Institute.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And what are we doing at the Scherer Institute?
It's a hospice. You're dying of cancer. I'm working.
Yeah, he says. Sure fucking thing. So right now, I'm lying in a bed dying of cancer someplace in Canada.
Yes, except it's not really right now.
Oh, yeah. How stupid of me. It's not now, and we're not here. So what's this job you're doing?
I'm a patch.
A patch, huh?
Okay, so what the fuck is a patch?
Like a software patch. To fix a bug or correct a mistake. Heard of that?
Obviously, dude, he says. Now he's getting into it a bit. The dope is making him philosophical. Not believing or disbelieving. Just getting into it a bit.
So, I'm dying of cancer, and you came back through time.
No, I'm not a time traveler. I'm a patch.
Oh, yeah, he laughs. You don't really think I believe any of this bullshit, do you?
I don't care.
Okay, Then what the fuck do you want from me? You don't have anything I want.
Great. So what are you doing here?
I came to say something to you.
So say it already, and take your lame bullshit to someone who gives a fuck.
I already said it. I'm done. Now I'm just enjoying the view.
Yeah, and Monday morning you'll be enjoying the view from your desk where you sell insurance or write shitty TV or whatever you do, laughing about the clever bullshit you pulled on some kid. Except you'd be lying because I just think you're just a fucking loser going through some bullshit about his lost youth or something.
That should be easy enough to confirm.
Yeah? How?
Do your parents have mystery guests to dinner a lot?
Find out my name.
Find out how your parents know me.
Come find me at my desk Monday morning and laugh at me.
He ponders thereon.
You're a trip, dude. I'll say that.
I'm just here to deliver the message.
Huh. So you already said it, right?
Said what, Patch?
What did you say?
Go ahead. Say it like I believe it. The year is 2066. We're at the Shearer Institute. You're bedridden and dying. You're practically a cadaver yourself. All that's really left of you is your dreams, your memories. You're reliving parts of your life in your mind. It's why you went to Canada and the Shearer Institute to die.
Oh, so now I'm not here at all. I'm just dreaming all this?
Dude, this just keeps getting better. Keep going.
In looking back on your life, you see yourself as a failure. You believe that you wasted your whole life, slept it away. You remember that it wasn't always that way, that you were once awake, alive, but then you drifted off in a doze like those people in there and just stayed that way.
Cool. So now I'm lying on my deathbed, regretting the fact that I slept through my life. So I send in a patch to fix things, so I'll live happily ever after. Maybe like you, huh? A real awake kind of guy?
Close. Not quite. There is no happily ever after. This isn't your life.
That is the deathbed.
And it's almost over. You're lying there in a semi-coma, dreaming your own life, and you want to dream it like it could have been, not like it was. So, at your request, a patch was inserted at the last point you remember having some balls.
Not uncommon. I have pretty much the same conversation a dozen times a week.
I manage to look appropriately bored. It's a while before he speaks again.
You're full of shit, dude, he says.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, okay. So you played your little head trip game. You delivered your little message. But it doesn't mean anything because I don't believe any of it. It's all just been a waste.
I look at him for the first time and turn back to the view.
Who's bullshitting who? Of course you believe it. You know it's true. Right now, you have some juice. But you know it won't last. Those people in there, those cadavers, that's your future. That's you in there. They were just like you, and you'll be just like them, a rat in a maze. It's true. You know it.
That shuts him up for a minute. Christine appears, Henry right behind her.
Have a nice life, dude, I tell the kid as he departs.
That was really something in there, Henry tells me excitedly. You have an awesome command presence. You should be on stage.
I look to Christine for some happy news. It'll be at least an hour for the car, she says.
Oh, no way. Henry, keys, please.
He hands them to me.
I can take you, he says.
I stare at him. He grins sheepishly.
You mad at me?
He asks.
No,
I say.
Really?
Really.
You sure?
Yes.
He looks glum.
Henry, I'm sure.
He brightens up.
That was so great, he says. That was so much fun. We'll be talking about tonight for years. You're absolutely right. There's so much more to life, so many possibilities. So what if it all came crashing down? What are we so afraid of? Are you sure you have to go? I thought you were...
I stand and take the least peopled route to the driveway, Christine and Henry following. I open the passenger door of Henry's car for Christine and settle myself into the driver's seat. Henry says some more goodbyes and makes me reassure him again that I'm not angry, which I'm not.
"You'll call me and let me know where to pick up the bins?" he asks.
The bins. Jesus, Henry, you're killing me with this shit.
You're right. You're absolutely right. When did I turn into such an asshole?
He asks, grinning crazily, as if it's all so damn wonderful. I laugh, because it is, and we drive away.
Chapter 4 Fish Story.
If man will strike, strike through the mask. How can the prisoner reach outside except by thrusting through the wall? Herman Melville, Moby Dick. I went to New York, but when I got there, I didn't know why I was there. I visited the hole where the World Trade Center had been. I ate a pastrami sandwich and watched the cleanup. I went to the top of the Empire State Building. I walked the streets for several hours, gradually ambling toward Greenwich Village and NYU, finally ending up in Washington Square, where I sat down on a bench. I sat there for an hour as the sun went down and told the universe I was going to stay put until it came up with a better idea. After a while, the phrase "baptism of solitude" appeared in my thoughts and quickly turned into a mellow yearning. So I figured, what the hell? I asked for it. A deal's a deal. I took a cab to Kennedy and booked a flight for Rabat by way of Madrid. I stayed in Assara, where I read Paul Bowles, Cormac McCarthy, some Faulkner, and a book of Civil War letters aloud to myself. When I'd had enough of that, I went to Marrakesh, where I read Pullman, Rowling, and Tolkien silently to myself. I avoided people and news and did less than I thought possible, while time reshaped itself around me. After a few months, I didn't feel like being there anymore. I flew back to New York and got a reservation on the Friday afternoon Hamptons Reserve train, the Cannonball. 3 hours later, I was in Montauk, and 2 months later, it's now. For these last few months, I've been like Jonah, consumed by a whale. I have immersed myself in the book Moby Dick, and only now am I really coming to understand it, only now seeing it for what it really is. It's an exciting process because I don't think anyone has seen it for what it really is before. I only started reading it because I'm staying in the house of a woman for whom Melville and Moby Dick have special meaning. She taught it for years before, when she was a college American lit teacher. And then, for many years, she and her late husband shaped their private lives around 19th century American shipping and whaling. And at the center of it all was Herman Melville's Moby Dick. Eastern Long Island is a good place to live if you have an interest in 19th century American whaling. The industry's history is all within a few hours by car and ferry. Sag Harbor, Cold Spring Harbor, Mystic, New Bedford, Nantucket, Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard. That's what Mary and Bill did for leisure. They traveled to these and similar places, visited the museums, read the books, bought the antiques and knick-knacks. They actually met in an ice cream parlor on Cape Cod, Four Seas, which is still in business, and they tried to get back there for every anniversary. Bill passed away nearly a decade ago. Since then, Mary has been working on a book about American whaling and Moby Dick that she plans to dedicate to him.
Long Island is also a good place to live if you have an interest in 19th-century American transcendentalists. Whitman was born here in Suffolk County, and I'm probably within a 2 or 3 hour drive of Walden Pond, Concord, and Camden. I don't plan on taking the tour, but being here has a nice feel to it. The den by the front door was used as Bill's office, and except for the addition of a laptop computer, it's probably pretty much the same as the last time he saw it. It's dark and warm and richly appointed in oak and leather. It holds a beautiful collection of law books and a separate collection of whaling and maritime books, including most everything ever written about Melville and the works of Melville, as well as hundreds of books relating to maritime life on the eastern seaboard. So I could hardly stay in a house like this and not at least try to read Moby Dick. Mary is in her middle 60s, tall, slender, Irish, Catholic. We've probably known each other since I was 5 years old because she and her husband were involved with my family's business, and Mary especially was like a member of my family. We've been out of touch for years, but then she helped out on some structural questions regarding my first book, Spiritual Enlightenment, The Damnedest Thing. She took a personal interest in the subject matter, and we renewed our acquaintance. She repeatedly invited me to come stay with her for as long as I wanted, so that's what I'm doing. Her house sits on Gardiner's Bay on eastern Long Island, out among the Hamptons, Sag Harbor, Shelter Island, and all that. There's a lot of money out here and a lot of tourism. I was raised on the other side of the Sound, and I still have family there and in Manhattan. Normally, I prefer to live well clear of money, tourists, and family, but I find myself pretty comfortable at Mary's. It's off the beaten path, quiet, secluded, and surrounded with good places for walking and biking. The front yard of Mary's house is mostly a peystone courtyard and driveway enclosed by a gated stone wall and thick, well-established trees. The house is small and quaint from the front, all white with a red front door, black shingles and shutters, well-developed shrubs and ivy, and a beech stone chimney. It's not attractive in front the way that many homes decorated for curb appeal are. It's not meant to impress guests and passers-by. Like many waterfront homes, the front of this house is more functional, and the back is where the emphasis has been put. It's a renovated 1920s fisherman cottage Mary and her late husband overhauled by gutting much of the interior to create large, high open spaces and adding back sweeping wings on both sides for bedrooms that enclose the outdoor living space of attached decks and shoreline behind. The house enfolds the backyard and is designed so that all the living spaces take full advantage of the view. The central part of the house contains a living room, dining room, and gourmet kitchen, which forms one large, open space with cathedral ceilings and tall windows and French doors that allow the interior to integrate with the outdoor spaces. The addition wings sweep out from the main part of the house, wrapping the yard in a gentle arc. There are two bedrooms in one of the wings. I'm staying in the outer, and the inner is vacant. In the other wing is the master suite with a large bath and walk-in closets. All three bedrooms have large windows and French doors accessing the oversized deck. It's not really a big house, but it's light and open and feels simultaneously spacious and cozy. A house like this goes for something well into the seven figures from what I can tell by reading local real estate listings. Mary could rent it in season for more a month than many people make a year, but she never has. This is the dream home she and her late husband bought and fixed up after raising their children, and she seems as attached to it as she is to her family. It's a good house for indoor-outdoor living. The Gulf Stream has a favorable influence on the climate here, keeping it a bit cooler in summer and a bit warmer in winter. The backyard is half filled by an oversized white deck attached to the house and stepping down in two tiers before opening out onto a small lawn and a magnificent view of the bay. The upper tier of the deck connects to the rear of the house, corner to corner. It's partially covered by pergola-type slatting, attached to the house like long white ribs. There's an umbrella-covered dining table and chairs, a barbecue, and a pair of lounge chairs. The back faces east, so there's plenty of morning sun, and shadows begin extending from the house after noon. The second level of the deck, as you head down, is more open and less used. There are some chairs, a built-in bench and railing to one side, and a hammock in its own frame tucked away in a spot of shade under an overhanging canopy of branches. Steps lead down through a low, evergreen hedge to a sunny quarter acre of well-groomed lawn and a path that leads down to the shore. The yard doesn't slope down to the water, but stays level until it reaches a weathered wood deck that runs along Mary's entire bay frontage like a boardwalk. A floating dock extends 20 feet into the bay. There's no boat, but sometimes guests come that way. There are some faded Adirondack chairs down there, and it's a great place to sit at dusk or dawn. Out on the bay, Orient Point, Gardner's Island, and the infamous Plum Island are all visible in the distance. I've always heard that Moby Dick was the classic example of the classic book that everyone agreed was a masterpiece, but that nobody actually read. Sitting at the table on the upper deck during one of my first days at Mary's house, I spent a few hours reading it, and could easily see why on both counts. It certainly had its high points in the first quarter. Ishmael and Queequeg meeting and becoming friends, signing aboard the Pequod, Father Mapple's sermon, foreshadowings of grand, ungodly, godlike Ahab. But it was definitely heavy and oddly structured, and I wasn't sure why I was reading it, or if I'd continue. It would be chapter 36, more than 150 pages in, before I'd have the first of two delightful epiphanies about this book. It was Ahab himself who encouraged me to look a little deeper. It was in the scene where the ship has sailed and Ahab rallies the crew to his cause, the hunt of the white whale. His first mate, Starbuck, is hesitant to turn the ship and crew away from the business of whaling to the business of revenge. Ahab asks Starbuck if he is not game for Moby Dick. "I am game for his crooked jaw, and for the jaws of death too, Captain Ahab, if it fairly comes in the way of the business we follow. But I came here to hunt whales, not my commander's vengeance." Ahab takes Starbuck aside and says, "Hark ye yet again, the little lower layer. All visible objects, man, are but as pasteboard masks. But in each event, in the living act, the undoubted deed, there, some unknown but still reasoning thing puts forth the moldings of its features from behind the unreasoning mask. If man will strike, strike through the mask, how can the prisoner reach outside except by thrusting through the wall? To me, the white whale is that wall shoved near to me. Sometimes I think there's not beyond, but 'tis enough." It's a magnificent, exciting chapter, and I was reading happily along when this paragraph locked me up. Did he just say what I think he said? I read and reread it a dozen times. Could it be? It didn't seem possible, and yet there it was. Moby Dick had just become a very interesting book indeed. Just so we're all on the same page about this book, let me provide a quick summary. It starts with the most famous opening line in literature, "Call me Ishmael," the significance of which has never been fully appreciated, and recounts the adventures of the narrator as he becomes gloomy and turns to the sea and a whaling voyage in order to escape his dark despair. He and his newfound cannibal friend, Queequeg, sign aboard the Pequod out of Nantucket, captained by a one-legged enigma called Ahab. As mentioned, we're in chapter 36 before we know what's really going on, that the captain is monomaniacally bent on a single purpose, to kill the white whale. On a previous voyage, it was Moby Dick who took off Ahab's leg. Now, to all appearances, Ahab wants his revenge. The hunt follows the Pequod through many oceans and many meetings with other ships. It's a delightful story, delightfully told, abounding in unexpected humor and charm. The whole thing ends in a 3-day chase of Moby Dick, wherein the Pequod and all hands, save Ishmael, are lost. End of Disc 1.